From the Muses Studios in Showbiz USA, it's Clean Burn. I'm your host, Andrew Heelan. Every week on Clean Burn, I am joined by an entertaining guest to talk about a King of the Hill episode. This week's guest is Gina Zwicky of Gina Goes Outside. She is a biologist and naturalist who studies reptile immunogenetics. She is also a wildlife photographer, always posting quality frog and turtle content, and a professional cartoon consumer. Let's talk Season 1, Episode 3, Order of the Straight Arrow, with Gina Zwicky. All right, so here we are. It's Episode 3, Order of the Straight Arrow, and I am here with Gina Zwicky.
Hello, I am so excited specifically to be here. I love King of the Hill, and nobody has ever asked me just directly to come on and talk about this for, you know, like, an extended period of time. So thank you so much, Andrew, for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I've enjoyed speaking with you about King of the Hill over the years, and now the world can share our joy.
You love to see
it. We talk to each other. Yes, yes. She looks very joyful, trust me. So this episode, very early on in the series, we're talking episode 3. So things are still kind of working out. They haven't quite fleshed out all the characters. They are not exactly as we will know them in a few seasons. They all look a little different here. The animation is not quite where it is. They're still using like single cell over watercolors, which is a look I really like.
Yeah.
But it's obviously not the digital stuff that they'll get years down the road. And it's the voices still aren't quite there. They're getting a little closer. But we're just getting to see everybody. This is a big episode, I think, in that it's the first time that we see them outside of Arlen. Because up until now, we've seen them in the alley. They're on Rainy Street. We've seen them at the school. We've seen them at Strickland Propane, you know, driving around town. But we have not seen them, you know, leave the city of Arlen. So it's exciting as we get to explore Texas and begin that game of trying to figure out where the hell is Arlen.
Yeah.
It's in Texas, but we're. So they open up with the four guys. They're in the alley and they're talking about their times and Order of the Straight Arrow and going camping. And we get that flashback and you see the four dads, which are all clearly just, which is weird because you see they took the four characters. They designed an older version and a younger version. So the kids all kind of like them. The dads, as we know them, will not be quite the same. We'll meet Dale's dad a few years from now, and he does not look just like older Dale. And then the boys, they kind of get to talking. We meet Eustace for the first and last time. He's not very well, but I guess he needed to be there, the one who wasn't them. And then we'll meet a couple other boys who also don't really show up anywhere else. But they break them down and they show them the snipe hunt. They send them on a snipe hunt. Now, have you ever been on a snipe hunt? Did that ever happen to you in your camping adventures?
It never has, but I am to understand that a snipe is actually a real bird.
I only recently learned this.
Right? Me, in just researching this episode.
Honestly, I didn't want to sound that dumb, but yeah, I was researching this episode that I learned that a snipe is actually a real bird.
And I'm not sure if this is the real etymology of the name of the snipe, but I had heard that it's because they were so hard to catch and kill, and it had something to do with the word sniper. That could just be total bullshit.
I heard that,
I'm not
too.
Sure.
That sounds, yeah, that sounds a little made up to me.
I'll accept it. You know, like, what's a little whimsy, like, in my day?
Yeah. So I have no reason to dispute that other than it kind of sounds like bullshit.
Fair enough. I've accepted worse.
Yeah. So I never went on a snipe. I was aware of them. And I don't think I sent kids on a snipe hunt ever. I don't think I was ever in any way a part of a snipe hunt.
Were you a Boy Scout or like anything?
No, I was not. I was a Cub Scout up through Weeblos.
Mm.
I got my, what is this? Like, I think it's the Arrow of Light is what you get when you complete Weeblos. I never, it's such an unfortunate name. It really is. For those of you who don't know, Weeblos is broken down from We Be Loyal Scouts.
I did not know that. Okay.
Yes.
Great to know.
Which makes it sound bad in a different way. My biggest interest in Cub Scouts and what kind of really kept me going around, I was really into Pinewood Derby.
Right. Oh my God. Yeah. We did that. My brother did Pinewood Derby too. Yeah. It was so competitive and like cutthroat.
Yeah. It was pretty intense. My first year when I really didn't know what I was doing and my car looked kind of janky and I did okay. And then after year two, and part of it was, there was a guy who hung out at one of my dad's stores who used to be a big time Cub Scout leader. And so he knew all the ins and outs. He was like, oh, all right, I'm going to show you some tricks. And so that car, man, it was a beast. It was all sleek and smooth and nice and round. It had stickers on it. So I had like I had sponsors, like it was an actual racing car. I knew how to instead of my old one, I don't know, we'll just tape some pennies to the roof or whatever. This was no, it was hollowed out and then molten lead poured in there and sealed up. Yeah. So this and just figuring out how much graphite to put on the wheels. And so it was really good. And I think I got second in my pack that year.
Wow, that's big.
And then by the next year, and then I won the next couple of years. So,
but no beating animals to death in the woods at your experience.
No, we did none of that. That I recall, I don't doubt. I mean, there were some pretty rough kids in there. Might have been on a camping trip and they might have taken a stick to some animal.
But not you personally.
Not me personally, no. I was never a big beating animals with sticks kind of guy.
Yeah, unlike Bobby Hill, clearly. So
poor Bobby. And we'll get to him there. The old guys, though, they're still flashing back their first experience drinking together when Boomhauer bust out the Bloody Mary mix.
And isn't it just the mix, too?
It is, yeah. They zoom in so you can say add vodka. Yeah, so it's just the mix, which is a very, I guess they're what, 11, 10, 11 or something at this point. So of that age thing to do where you think you're drinking, you're not. And Bill's immediately yeah, this is my thing. Tomato juice.
I'm kind of surprised Cotton didn't give them real alcohol. That seems like it would be a very in-character thing to do.
I think at that point, he probably felt they had not earned it. Mm. Alcohol was for real men. He didn't think they were real men yet. And I like that we still haven't had a lot of Cotton exposure, but that they're showing him to us because it gives you that look like we got in the last episode where you see a little bit more of okay, this is how Hank was raised. This is why he's like this in a lot of ways. This is why he has this relationship with Bobby. And so, yeah, just the little glimpses of Cotton right now to warm us up and give a little more context to Hank. But then when they flash back and the guys are just thinking back, man, those times we had, and you just see them all, once again, they start to put the pieces together, where, Bill, just a great Bill line that I'm so depressed, I can't even blink.
Yeah. He wanted to be an astronaut.
Yeah. And or a pilot. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Astronaut or at least a pilot. And then, Dale was going to live in England and have people murdered. Mm-hmm. And Hank was, of course, going to sell propane. He always knew where he was going. And there's a deleted scene from that where they all get really it's really an extended scene, I guess, not deleted, where they all get really angry at Hank just for bringing it up and pointing out how terrible their lives are. We see a little more of Dale, and this is the version of Dale's dad that exists here that will not exist in the future, where he explains his dad told him never trust nobody. And it's all right, the Dale's coming together. And then he isn't present physically much in this episode, but you feel him a lot as we see John Redcorn roll up.
Oh my God. That's the best part of this episode, in my opinion.
It's so wonderful. And we're still establishing that John Redcorn is, he's got the thing going on with Nancy and everybody knows except Dale.
Yeah.
Who can see all the conspiracy theories except the ones that are right in front of his face. This is also special. It is, you'll notice a different voice. This is Victor Aaron, the original voice of John Redcorn, who between the recording of this and it airing, passed away. He died in a car crash at age 39. But this is one of the few times you get to hear, only one of two times really, you get to hear that voice of John Aaron. And so the voice, and this episode was dedicated to him. But yeah, he really just a couple of things where he's very into Nancy and the great line where he tells Dale that he would be honored to look after his wife while he's out of town and the looks from everybody. So it's all right, we know what's going on here. And then he starts talking about nature and where they bring in the flutes and his hair blows. And you're like, yes, this is the John Redcorn that we will get to know and love.
They really make it so easy to sympathize with John Redcorn too, because he's here telling these just jackasses about, sacred practices of his nation and knowing that they're going to do something stupid with it and, clearly resentful. And, we'll get into it later in the episode, how they get their comeuppance for that.
And there was never a point, I thought, once he started talking where he was clearly they will respect me and my people. And
he just seems so beleaguered.
Yeah. but it's working out all right for him. We see Joseph and Bobby. They're excited. They're curious. They don't know what's going on. What are these initiation rituals? They're going to have to walk over hot coals. Who knows? Peggy pops in, catches them almost cussing, which is just a great mom moment. A great Peggy moment. Peggy referring to herself in the third person, like that's so that's a very early trope that she jumps in with. Joseph thinks Peggy's cool.
It smells like Miracle Whip.
Smells like Miracle Whip. Which I don't know if that's something that he always thinks about her, if it was just in that moment that maybe she'd put on like some weird night cream that to Joseph smelled like mayonnaise. I don't know. No one has ever accused Joseph or Bobby of being extra smart. So now we cut, and then their parents are talking about it, and we get like another great moment where as they look back and are flashing back to what happened, and Hank just kind of thinks, you know, well, imagine how I could have turned out if my dad supported me and everything I did. And you just like, which really kind of another just really hits at the heart of this episode and this series, really, in my mind. Peggy, now at this point, it's the next morning. She's trying to get everybody out the house. She has an agenda. Luann is off for her mom's arraignment. Peggy gives her the fun saver, which is...
Take lots of pictures.
Here's the fun saver. Take lots of pictures. I probably somewhere in my life just have several of those disposable cameras that were just never developed and have just been lost to time. There was that period, you know, before everyone had a digital camera and certainly before everyone had a phone where that's how you did it. And you know, you'd go to weddings and they would just have them on every table at the reception and, not a good time. I don't necessarily think as far as the way we were, cause we had took all these pictures, but there was nowhere to upload them then. So then you just had to have albums.
Then you feel guilty about throwing them away. Yeah. Like eventually when they get too many.
Yeah. And they're, you don't need them. You're burdensome, like, I don't even know truly. That person.
Yeah.
It really is. It really is. Digital's the way to go when it comes to photos. But yeah, she, and then a thing that we kind of touch on, and it sort of comes up in this, as Peggy, and I don't know if it's so much in her haste to get everybody out, but she's definitely taking charge, like carrying the big suitcase, putting it in the trunk. When all the men are just standing around, when the car won't start, she's pushing it. She is just roll starting that thing. Peggy is definitely a sturdy woman. Mm-hmm. I think you could describe her as, but I don't know if this was necessarily her showing off her strength or it was just her desire to get everybody out so she could get on the road.
Mm-hmm. This is such a good B plot.
Yeah. It's very, and it's small. There's not a lot to it. No, it's small. Huh? That's kind of, but yeah, it one of those, another one just like really gets us an insight into Peggy. And so, yeah, then everybody's off on their journeys and we are outside of Arlen. They get to John Wayne State Park, which was an interesting choice for them for naming the park. John Wayne is one of those, not a Texan, but is very beloved by Texans, especially Hank Hill, as we see throughout the series. John Wayne's a Californian and his real name is Marion, which we also learn comedically in a few seasons. But I look at that as like Texans naming a state park after John Wayne is kind of like people from Alabama who are really into Ronnie Van Zant. It's like Lynyrd Skynyrd's not from Alabama, but they've just sort of adopted him as their own. Peggy's on her way out to Lubbock now. And she hits that dead part of Texas, which I've driven through many times, and I'm aware, where there's no radio. It doesn't exist. You can scan. You can go 88.1, 88.3, 88.5. You're not going to get anything. There's nothing there. I guess the truck didn't have a tape deck. I don't know what was going on. I thought it was a great comedic choice that she picked a specific static to listen to, though.
Yeah.
She was like, this one is the most soothing for driving past oil derricks.
They're so good at those little tiny animation choices and one-offs that are just so funny.
And one of those that, like, on paper, that look not in, like, Peggy flips through radio stations, nothing but static settles on one. Like, mm-hmm. That does not read as funny. But when it's played out, great, great joke. We get there, they're all settling in, we pass the environmentalist, who I immediately think, well, these are going to be the antagonist for this episode. Obviously, the boys and Hank and the guys from the alley are not going to see eye to eye with the environmentalist. That's where our conflict's coming, and not really. So Hank thanks them all for being there, thanks the Earth for the propane that it provides. Has the boys pledge against voting on a bill that brings in South American propane. Hank clearly has an agenda, and he is pushing it on the Order of the Straight Arrow. All right, so it's hunting time. Bill gives everybody a whoop-ass stick, which I think we should all have a whoop-ass stick in our life. Like, even if you don't have an actual stick that you plan on beating people or animals with, I think just your own metaphorical whoop-ass stick.
Yeah, symbolic
that you
whoop-ass.
That you can take to you in the woods that are life and beat any mythical creatures that may try to bring you down.
Maybe it's your own demons you and your well-being. In the end.
It might be. Maybe you need to whoop your own ass with a stick. Maybe that's what you're looking for. But yeah, find your whoop-ass stick in life, guys. Know it. Carry it with you. Oddly enough, a whoop-ass stick is used on a whooping crane, which I don't think was quite what they were looking for here. Now, Bobby kills a whooping crane, and he's initially proud of himself because he thinks he's killed a snipe. Hank immediately mortified. Hank also immediately recognizes a whooping crane, which props to him.
Yeah, seriously.
I'm not that good with ornithology. I said that right.
Definitely.
Yeah. I know a few birds. I can definitely especially the bigger ones maybe. But I don't know I could 100% spot a whooping crane.
I think it was like a thing right at that moment in history where it was becoming more and more of a issue in the cultural awareness.
It might have been. Yeah. I don't, cause this was 97. I think. Yeah. I don't remember particularly whooping crane dialogue in the zeitgeist there in the mid 90s when they would have been writing this episode. I don't know that I've ever seen a whooping crane, which does not make me unique. There's not a lot of them. I know that at one point, maybe back in like mid 20th century, so like the 50s or so, that they were down to, I want to say like maybe like 20 or so whooping cranes in North America. There were just not a lot around. Now I think they're back up to about 800.
That sounds about right. I can't say that I'm the most well-versed in ornithology.
No. I've looked into it a little bit, and I know whooping crane, just because where we live here in South Louisiana, in New Orleans, like there's some around here out in the park where I know we both spend a lot of time out in the city park. There's an abundance of birds, but also there's other birds that are like I may have thought I saw a whooping crane, but it was a great egret or something.
I feel like a whooping crane would have been like out further into a marshy area. I wouldn't think that you would see one in the limits. Park. But yeah, there are a lot of, tall wading birds that are mostly white that,
that been a great heron or something. Mm-hmm. But they're pretty big. I think if I remember this correctly, they're the tallest North American bird.
That sounds like it could be correct.
That's a stat that I have bouncing around in my head.
Like three bird facts, and that's not one of them. Yeah, but sounds correct. Yeah. Let's go with that.
They're definitely very tall. And I know they have a pretty large wingspan. They're like 6 or 8 feet. Mm-hmm. Like,
they're big birds.
It's a big bird. Most times when I see a whooping crane is when you go to the Pelicans game, the NBA franchise here in New Orleans, and they have the, during an intermission or a timeout, they'll have on the scoreboard three birds that race, and one of them is a whooping crane named Frazier.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, yeah. That's adorable.
Yes. And so you like pick the one, and then if it wins, you cheer. There's no prize. It's just a thing on the video board to distract you from the fact that the Pelicans are blowing out their fourth quarter lead. And I'm pretty sure they're omnivorous, like that they eat, oats and barley and hops. I don't know. Like,
most birds that have that shape of beak are mostly piscivorous, so they eat fishes, frogs and little stuff that they can grab at. But yeah, I'm actually not sure.
Maybe like little like shrimp or crabs or something like that. Yeah. Basically things that as best I understand what we're hearing, like if you had a lake and then the water level went down, the things that would kind of be in that mud and in the very shallow parts.
Yes. Yes,
those kind of
precisely.
Right, yes, there we go. All right, I know things. So Bobby killed one of those beautiful creatures that we've been discussing, which was a real shame.
Misuse of the whooping stick.
Yes. Well, actually, I think the intended use of the whooping stick, they were just, they didn't intend it to be whooped.
Yeah.
There was no whooping to be done. This was all a ruse, which Bobby was not into, because Bobby did not think his dad would lie to him. And which is really sweet. And Hank, the whole point of him was that what it was when he was a kid, that like, okay, the boys are going to go out in the woods. They're going to figure out that their parents have lied to. Then we will bond together against this older generation. But Bobby doesn't want to fight his dad. He wants to be friends with his dad. And it's really endearing. And we see more of that later. So the next morning, things are starting to, obviously, the whooping crane has to come home to roost here. Consequences have to be met. And so as they're getting, everybody's kind of waking up, we see one of the hippie ladies run out of Boomhauer's tent in the background, which is another nice little gag they threw in. Gives them a little kiss on the way out, though. So they had a nice romantic moment. Now, at what point Boomhauer was able to wander away from the campgrounds, pick up a woman, get her back in the tent? I mean, it's some of his more impressive wooing. He was woo-woo-woo-looing. I regret saying that already. But yeah, and so the park ranger comes up, and Boomhauer admits it. He tells the park ranger everything, and the first time we kind of get to see this gag, where we realize that, oh, okay, it's not just us. A lot of people don't understand Boomhauer. Because we're really sure. It's like, do we just, the audience, we don't get him? Because clearly, all of his friends, they understand everything he says. And like, no, because the park ranger, no idea what he said. And now we're going to get back to the Peggy story. Peggy has made her way to Lubbock. She's in the big shoe store. She walks past the wall where they just have the autographed photos, I guess, of the other famous women. And the only one that I could definitely spot, I'm sure there were some other gags, and there was definitely a Janet Reno in there. Janet Reno, attorney general for the Clinton administration. She was, her relationship to Texas, she was very much in charge of the raid on the Branch Davidian compound in Waco. A nice little trivia note to remember here for the future of the series. Peggy shoe size 16 triple E. Which is massive. I know I am a like 11 and a half double E, which is like average-ish for a guy. If you don't mind me asking, I know this is a very personal question. Shoe size.
I'm shoe size 8, and I don't even know what E means.
That's the width.
That should tell you? Okay. Yeah.
So not E, a common like, thing. E would kind of be narrow, double E would kind of be like medium, then triple E would be like really wide.
Damn, yeah, the big boys. Yes. So, yeah.
So she's I've never got a foot that's at least twice as large as yours.
Wow.
Which is.
That's some queen shit, honestly.
That is. I mean, and they get into her big feet a few more times, but not just like, I don't know, does that affect like. Or her balance, her ability to run, because she's not that tall. So it's a really large foot for a woman of that height.
But I don't know, she's of hardy peasant stock, you know? So kind of comes with the territory.
They're trying to figure all this out, and Joseph's telling everybody lying, and Bobby's like, I don't really want to be against my dad. And then the ranger finds it, and as they're trying to get away, and they've got this whole master plan, but the hippies have seen them. I got the ranger part a little ahead of there. Hippies have seen them, and we just get like just some blatant dramatic irony here as the angry hippies like stomp through and like smash a bird's nest with all the eggs in it, like not egg on their face, but egg on their feet, and they're ripping up weeds and getting over there. So yeah, this is kind of we see, these hippies are all hypocrites. Still not even really sure why these people are all gathered in the park, what they were doing there, but we needed an antagonist. They were there. So as they're trying to escape through the park, and the ranger gets them, and the bird is there, and Bobby's trying to bring it back. He's holding it out the window. He's doing everything he can just to put life into this bird and bring in the spirit of Wimatanye, which he's very much believing in, and just splashing water on it. And then the bird, as the ranger's ready to bust them all, comes back. And Bobby, of course, feels like he did this, as he says, I'm a shaman. Which unfortunately they didn't pursue. I would have loved to have seen more of Bobby believing he was a shaman and had powers over even just birds to have them do his bidding. That could have been a lot of fun. But yeah, it's where we kind of get to that point where they're realizing, the ranger does specify that it would have been against the law to kill it, but they just knocked it unconscious. And that's not against the law, but also probably not good for the bird.
It is against the law, for the record. It's definitely against the law.
So you can't just go knock a bird unconscious. That would also...
No, no matter how tempting it may be. You know.
Okay, that's good to know. I'm not really looking to do that. I have some annoying birds that are around me in the morning sometimes. but they usually... I wouldn't know where... Like, I don't think I could get close enough to them to hit them with a stick. I don't think they would allow me to do that.
Yeah, it was truly a physical feat, you know, on Bobby's part to, like, even catch this whooping crane. Like, yeah. He's, what, like, 12 at this point and, like, not really in shape. So.
No.
Got to give him props for that.
Bobby, once again, you know, we'll see him fail at hunting later, but maybe this is, he didn't need a gun. He just needed a stick.
The power of wanting to win his father's love, yeah. You know?
And which is he did, like as Hank is trying to explain it to him, where he's just like, you know, I don't want to be against you. You're my dad. And it's just, that's a really sweet moment. And that's, I don't know, what kind of brought me back to this series on my like most recent rewatch, what inspired me to start this podcast, sitting around, pandemic and all of that. And what I kept being drawn to was like familiar and wholesome. Mm-hmm. And yeah, this is one of those shows where it on the surface doesn't have that like touched by an angel kind of vibe of wholesomeness. But yeah, you just always see that the Hank and Bobby, you know, looking at the world through different lenses but always trying to come together and making it work. And they kind of did it right here. So.
Yeah, this was one of the most notable episodes for me just because it did such a good job so early on of establishing the groundwork, I guess, for the important traits of all the characters that were featured in it.
Yes.
And I really appreciated especially having the backdrop of Cotton Hill presented earlier in the series even, mm-hmm. and then brought up at the beginning of the episode to serve as sort of a foil to Hank and Bobby's relationship.
Yeah, even though Cotton is not present in any of the like scenes as they're happening in real time here, he's only seen in the flashbacks. But Cotton is always in any scene Hank is in. Mm-hmm. It's in there. And yeah, you see Hank with that just desire to please his dad. And then that same thing, we see this kind of wanes as the series goes on, as Hank kind of just gets to know his son better. But he's very much like, yep, we have to do things that make Bobby a man because that's what boys do. Boys become men. And that's what my dad did to me. And here we go. But yeah, it's another one. It's one of the early standout episodes, of which there were many. That's mm-hmm. the thing that surprises me. Like whenever I go back to watch this, because in my head, I'm thinking it's like so many shows that takes a few years to get going, but man, they had so much of it right off the bat.
Yeah, Mike Judge is just such an incredible like writer for animation, especially just because so many of the gags are visual. You know?
And it's not like a lot of other animation. The Simpsons will always. They have a lot of background gags. They're always mm-hmm. walking past a sign that's funny, and there's a lot of stuff which I love. I eat that stuff up. Yeah. I love the kind of show that I have to like pause and go away. Definitely not a lot of cut. It has flashbacks, but not really cutaway gags, mm-hmm. Which are just all over animation now. And yeah, they really just like found these very simple characters that are relatable to so many different people.
Mm-hmm. And they do a really good job of not making any of them unlikable, despite their sometimes very, very significant and prominent flaws.
Yes.
So even there's a lot of Peggy Hill hate. I love Peggy. Like I unabashedly love,
yes.
love Peggy. So again, she's not one of the more prominent characters in this episode, I guess.
She's definitely a B plot, but yeah. Yeah, but coming off the last one, which was like very Peggy heavy and square peg, where she's mm-hmm. teaching sex ed and everything, and very much at the center and the focus of the episode. Yeah, and Peggy delivers on a B plot too,
mm-hmm.
and not a lot of lines, not a lot of scenes, but she makes them all count. And just the building that anticipation of like, what is she doing? Where is she going? Something nefarious is afoot. Chose my words carefully there.
Yeah.
And no, she's just, she has big feet and she's kind of ashamed of it.
I think one of the funniest little visual gags in the entire episode for me was when at the very end you see her scraping the one out of the 16 on the shoebox as though it's a secret, you know, that she has these gigantic like clown feet, you know, yes. from her husband. And he seems genuinely oblivious. Like,
oh yeah, that very much seen. Like, what is that? And like, it's a microwave. Like, mm-hmm. we go through microwaves. Like most families go through shoes. They're in the little, in the credit scene. Yeah, and Hank, clearly at no point anywhere in this series shows he has an issue with the size of Peggy's feet.
Mm-hmm.
He's been aware of it, and it's definitely. I mean, I don't doubt that it's caused some points of stress. And Peggy has put some shame on herself for this. But yeah, the one, just the idea of a shoe that is 6EEE is kind of hilarious because mm-hmm. Like a tiny little foot that's really, really wide.
Mm-hmm.
and yeah, that she has this specific place. The another like thing I really liked of hers that was just a little meaningless gag, just kind of setting up, is when she tries to burn the ATM receipt. She's like, create no evidence, not realizing that by using the ATM, you've created evidence. And Peggy would not be a great criminal, in case we were ever wondering about that.
And she proves that later in the series.
She's not much of a confidence man.
Oh yeah, but you'll touch on that later.
Yeah, we'll get there. Yeah, sure. it's kind of weird sometimes because, you know, we're talking about a series that I'm assuming most people who are listening to this have watched the entirety of, and so
probably it's multiple
not like,
times. Yeah,
right. Yeah, yeah. It's not like, oh, we got spoilers, because it's like I just assume that, like, yeah, you're listening, this show went off the air, you know, over a decade ago.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about stuff. But yeah, it also, but like, it's hard to sometimes not want to just like jump ahead. Cause if this was just a conversation at a bar, then yeah, we would jump ahead and be like, oh my God, let's talk about that.
Oh yeah. All these tie-ins.
Lock it all into season one, episode 3, Order of the Straight Arrow here. Now, as far as the way that, they handled, just being out in nature, As characters in the show or just as people, do you think that they were respectful of nature and the animals around them?
I think that that's an interesting question because you see Hank throughout the series so deeply reverential for nature and seeing it as a point of Texan pride, you know, and heritage. But in this episode, you know, they're just going out being good old boys in the woods and like letting these kids go out and beat on whatever they find. I don't think that they necessarily expected any of them to actually find any animals.
Oh, no.
So I think the case could be made that they were trying their best to be respectful of nature. Being respectful of a lot of other things, you know, certainly not. But
yeah, not of, you know, John Redcorn's culture, for sure.
But it was definitely interesting to see them as sort of compared to the hippies, who were just so, like, hateable because of the obvious hypocrisy and the dramatic irony moment that you mentioned, where you just see them running after these, you know, scapegoats for environmental degradation and just like stomping on birds' nests and like killing animals and stuff in the process. And this is a really real thing that, as somebody who works in environmental science and conservation biology, like, you see a lot of, you know, people who are very, very superior about their opinions about nature, preservation of nature, etc. But in the end, it's all very performative. And when it comes down to it, they really are sometimes even worse about consumption than the people that they like to criticize. So I thought that that was really funny. And also, very ahead of its time, I guess. Like you mentioned, this just was not something that people were really aware of in a widespread manner back then.
No, and the way you and you're in nature all, like, basically every day. There's not this isn't just like a weekend thing or you go camping once in a while. You're out there every day, so you get to see probably a lot of times. I'm guessing, like, when you're in the parks and stuff, you are interacting with other people who are enjoying it on a more casual basis than you, but still there's the interest. But and I don't think most people are willing, like, going out and like, yes, I am going to destroy the environment. But I think it's like so much else in life where it's like, well, if I just do a little littering, that's okay. It's just one plastic bottle if I do it. But then if you see somebody else do it, very much a tisk tisk.
And the number one thing is that I see with, you know, the sort of crunchy people that I'll meet out in the woods and stuff is they fancy themselves very environmentally friendly. And then they have their dogs off leash, like harassing and killing like box turtles and tearing up the ground and like pooping everywhere. And that's just totally swept under the rug. So, yeah, I do see a lot of that.
Yeah, because if there's, you're in nature, so you're free to let the dog be free, which is not true. That dog doesn't belong there.
Yeah, exactly.
Nothing against your dog, but yeah, that's not that dog's natural habitat. These animals that are there have not prepared to have a dog as a predator.
Yeah, it's a very pervasive mindset. Yeah. You know, it's okay if it's just me and it's just a little bit, you know?
Yeah. But yeah, there's, what are the animals that you think, what are some, like, the common animals that you run into that you think people have just misconceptions about?
So there are so many. I think probably snakes, and particularly venomous snakes, living in South Louisiana is one of them. Because people seem so terrified of the idea of coming across a venomous snake, but I go out looking for them constantly. And the amount of times I actually find them, you know, when I'm actively there, like digging through like piles of leaves in the woods, like looking like a complete weirdo, like, is so infrequent. So I think that people also have this conception of them as aggressive or actively dangerous. I mean, I see cottonmouths pretty regularly.
I know that blows my mind when you post pictures of cottonmouths because
they're everywhere.
Yeah. It's in my head. That's the most dangerous. I mean, I didn't grow up around somewhere with like rattlesnakes or something. So cottonmouths were the one that we were the most fearful of. And I will say that I was definitely. They were an enemy to us growing up. That's something I would have had a whooping stick for.
And that's a lot of people around here, but I photograph them regularly at safe but pretty close distances, and they just don't even care. They, like, don't even really look at me. And the same is true of alligators, which is another animal that sort of gets a bad rap, especially to people who aren't from the area. Alligators are so lazy. It's the alligators, ridiculous. If you see it, it's not a threat most of the time. You know, it's out in the sun, just vibing, you know, absorbing this little solar power. I've never once felt threatened in any way by an alligator, but that's just because I have common sense and use it when around them.
Right. Yeah. I've never tried to get closer than I felt necessary to an alligator. People have a lot of questions to come here about alligators. And I mean, it's our state reptile and we definitely push it real big with our tourism, you know, come take a swamp tour, see an alligator and all of that. And that's usually, it was like alligators are incredibly lazy. They want to eat enough to keep them going. That's it. And that's pretty much the only thing they want to put energy to is food. They're not just, you know, fucking with you.
Ideal lifestyle, honestly. Yeah. Like, I see alligators just out, kind of, like, spread out on, like, a muddy patch of grass or something, just looking way happier than I may ever be in my life. I'm like, to know this bliss, truly.
That's it. Yeah. It's a very content animal. It's also an apex predator.
Yeah.
But it's not, they're not on the hunt. That's not how they live.
And I mean, I've seen them on the hunt. Like, sometimes I'll be out at night and I'll see them snap up a nutria, and that's always really cool. So infrequent, you know.
So for those of you who don't know, nutria is a very large rodent that we have here in South Louisiana. Not a native species. They were brought here and immediately became very invasive and got really good at breeding, and they actually are not good for our environment. They eat plants that help, like, keep the land together, basically, right?
That is one of the big ones. They eat a lot of the grasses that kind of are important to prevent erosion, which is a humongous problem in South Louisiana. They also kind of outcompete native animals like muskrats, which is less of a problem on a grand scale of, you know, existential questions.
Right.
Still not good.
Yeah. But it's a large rodent. I mean, think of the size of a beaver or so.
Something like, they can be pretty big. Yeah. In the 15 pound range, something maybe bigger.
But big orange teeth. And they're, we kind of use them like literally as mascots and stuff down here kind of whimsically, but they're not good. But yeah, it's imagining, I mean, an alligator eating a nutria is about the most South Louisiana thing you can come up with.
That's direct action.
Yes, that's direct. Yeah. So the alligators are out there. They're trying to prevent erosion.
Yeah, doing God's work, truly.
What are you doing, people? How are you preventing an erosion? Are you eating nutria? I hope you're not. You might be wearing nutria. If you ever bought some fake fur, it might have been nutria. You might have got that slip past you.
I would. I'd look into that.
You could market that down here. Oh, people would buy nutria pelts and nutria hats.
There are falconers who have entire businesses working around just catching nutria, selling the tails for the tail bounty, and then selling the carcasses to dog food companies. That's a huge
thing.
And
just to clarify, there is a tail bounty here because I don't know how, if I think they just do it at certain times, but I know at least Jefferson Parish that the nutria is bad enough that they used to say, if you bring in a nutria, you killed, we'll give you, I don't know what the bounty currently is. But
I think it's $7 currently per tail. Which
$7.
Is not too bad if you're really in high volume.
No. Well, they had to modify that and eventually be like, okay, just bring in the tails. Because then somebody's just showing up with like a dozen of these very large dead rodents.
What do you do with that? Yeah.
Yeah. And so they're like, you know, if you bring in the tail, we're going to assume you killed it. And So we still have a whole hunter trapper economy going down here. And to know that there's people, that's not even their side hustle, that's like their main gig is just, you know, snuffing nutria,
and they're doing more good for the world than the hippies.
Yes, look at them, come on hippies, kill some rodents. Obviously that wouldn't go well, but for comedic purposes that would be a good scene of just going to a Greenpeace-ish type meeting and like, all right, guys, here is the DA that we need to do. Our direct action is going to be, we're going to go kill a bunch of Nutria.
Get the feral hogs.
Yes,
no?
Get the feral hogs. Yes. Which we don't have as much down here.
We do have them actually.
They exist, but
in Lafitte, I got very, very, very intimidated a couple of weeks back. I was out in the swamp and I got kind of lost. I went a little bit off trail because there was like a fallen tree over the road. And it takes about 5 feet of going off trail before you're just like in East Bluff. You have no idea where you are.
Right.
And I was like hearing the sounds of like snuffling pigs around me and seeing pig poop all around.
Oh, no.
And I was like in knee deep mud, like kind of dusk is setting. I'm just like, am I going to fucking die out here? Like, is this how I go? But eventually I like clawed my way out of the being lost in the swamp and ended up just seeing like the feral hogs in the distance. And I was just absolutely terrified. So, yes. That is my number one fear. I would hunt.
So not alligators,
no.
Not snakes.
Oh no. Feral hogs. It's the hogs that you got to be worried about, yeah.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't know how to defend myself against one feral hog, I'd be like, "All right, I'll just take some shots at this guy, I guess." But yeah, if there's would they be a pack?
They do travel in groups.
Yeah, I know I know they're in groups. So. Mm-hmm. But it was like I don't know, what is it, a pack of
herd,
maybe, yeah.
A conglomeration of feral hogs.
Group,
yeah, I don't know.
Multiple feral hogs.
I think the only thing to do is just climb a tree, you know? Like, you hit a pig and you don't kill it with the first shot, like, now it's just mad. And goodbye you know? So I try to stay close to trees with dangly branches just in case when I'm by myself in the
swamp. That's good. That's a smart little survival tip there. I don't usually go as deep into the swamps as you do, so
but that's fine. That's probably wise.
It's one of those, because I think more of like when I where I grew up, we didn't really have swamps, and so the thing was, I'd be like, you got lost in the woods, the go-to thing was you find like a creek usually, or maybe like a river, some type of stream, and you follow that because eventually that will lead you to where some people are, because they're always going to be near flowing water. You don't have that in the swamp, though.
No. Yeah, bye-bye.
There's no flowing water. There's no thing that naturally gets to people. You're just in it.
Mm-hmm. So you better learn what you can eat. So
yeah. Now, if you manage to kill a feral hog, that can keep you going for a while. That's a lot of meat, but...
Yeah, I train for this every day. Don't worry.
We'll be back to talk more Order of the Straight Arrow with Gina Zwicky right after this. If you were a King of the Hill character, who would you be?
Bobby, no question.
Bobby,
no hesitation.
No question.
I've related so strongly to so many of Bobby's moments and sort of plot points. And particularly in this episode, just seeing his wholehearted appreciation for the world around him and his serious, like, sincere reverence for this crane that he has accidentally brought, harm to.
Yes.
I definitely relate to that.
Yeah, and Bobby was clearly upset about this, but he did not feel a need to, he wasn't trying to avoid responsibility for it. He was sad, but he wasn't just mourning it. He was like, no. I did this, and I'm going to fix this.
Mm-hmm. He's got a very make it right perspective on a lot of things.
And he believed enough in the spirits of Propane and John Redcorn's ancestors that, he was like, I'm going to try to bring this back. Yeah. So anything else, like, what do you see in Bobby? Like, that willingness to, like, try new things, put yourself out there. What's Bobby about Gina?
I think it's the sincerity. I am kind of unabashedly sincere, and that's something I had to work for, I guess, and Bobby was just lucky enough to be born with it, but I feel like that's part of his charm, is just being so overtly sincere and like willing to believe what others tell him and accept things at face value.
Yeah, Bobby, a real gem. He's sincere, he's very honest, like, and he's Bobby's never, as much as the many experiments he has, he's very rarely trying to get over on people.
Mm-hmm. He's also very emotionally open, especially with his dad, in a way you can tell clearly makes Hank very uncomfortable.
Oh, yes, yes.
And this is sort of how I am with my own dad. So this has been a dynamic that we've had, for a long time that I relate very heavily to. But
yeah, he has that. He has the sincerity. You said he has that openness. And he also has a confidence about him that you in no way would think he would have. Just with his physical stature and everything, you wouldn't see, like, Bobby is going to be the kid in the class who's really can puff his, and it's not a puff his chest out kind of confidence. I'm Bobby Hill and people like me.
Yeah, that's what it really all comes down to, is realizing that in the end, all people really care about is if you have a good personality.
Yeah.
The right people, at least. And I think Bobby, from a very early age, shows that he is keyed into being liked by the right people most of the time, and also pretty immune to the obvious, you know, minor scorn that he gets from his dad. It seems like it sort of goes right off his back, you know, when his dad is criticizing him for being unmanly or, you know, soft or whatever it is. And Hank doesn't often directly criticize him. It'll be more to Peggy, you know, like that boy, right, you know, but Bobby seems pretty well insulated from that.
Awesome. Excellent call. Gina is Bobby. I see that. All right. So here we are, this episode. What was your favorite line of the episode?
I think it has to be that line where Hank was talking about what he would be like if his father had loved him no matter what.
Can you imagine how it would have turned out if my dad loved me no matter what?
It was so funny. It was sort of a wrap-up line for the whole episode, too, because
the whole series.
Yeah, yeah. Well, ultimately, this kind of microcosm of the series itself was about the relationship between Hank and Bobby and how it differed from what Hank had experienced growing up. So I thought it was both hilarious and just a good representation of the episode and the series as a whole.
I agree. That was also my pick, but so that we don't pick the same thing, I will go to option two, which is, I'm kind of torn. I'm going to go with "I'm so depressed I can't even blink."
Oh, that was a good one too. Oh my God. Classic Bill.
Barely beating out "She Smells Like Miracle Whip."
Mm-hmm. I think my number two was the one where the park ranger is explaining to the hippies that are kind of going after Hank and crew about the snipe. Because they say, "Oh, they were hunting snipe last night, too, I heard." And he's just like, "There is no snipe." And she throws back her head and starts wailing. My God, how many species will have to be wiped out before we learn? And just instantly afterwards starts, like, trampling through the brush. I thought that was so funny.
Yeah,
just,
that was another good showing the hippies what they were really all about. Yes. Okay. MVP of the episode.
It's also got to be Bobby.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you can make an argument for Peggy just because she just...
That
executed successfully, got what she wanted, you know, but definitely Bobby, kind of showing Hank the error of his ways and how to truly have honor and take responsibility for a situation, you know, so definitely Bobby.
Very mature for an 11-year-old. Yeah, he never tried to deflect, because that thing that so many kids will do, it's like, I did something wrong. All right, I got to run and I got to lie. That was what I did. He didn't. He stood there and he tried to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And in his mind, he did fix it because he's a shaman now. All right. What's your lesson? What lesson did you take out of this? Is there anything?
I think that there were a couple. The number one lesson is that you don't have to create an atmosphere where your kid can feel, you know, like he can bond with his peers by being against you. It's just as easy and a lot more healthy to develop an environment where your kid can be your friend in an age-appropriate way, obviously, but... kind of Hank realizing that these things that Cotton had instilled in him with regards to what a father-son relationship should look like don't ever have to be that way. I think another kind of side lesson you can get, I thought that the whole arc about just, you know, John Redcorn giving them this very sincere warning, like not to take these things lightly, and that it was actually like a very sacred thing that they were messing with and demeaning and making light of, and then them experiencing what I viewed as severe consequences
for
just being like dickheads about that.
Yeah. Not quite the trope of like the native curse, but it kind of there. It's one of those like, you will have your actions have consequences and you were warned.
Yeah.
And here you are.
Yeah. I love John Redcorn. He's one of my favorite characters. So I had to throw that one in.
I think a lesson I'm going to take from this is, it's pretty easy to get one over on a park ranger.
Yep. That's true. It's true.
People who go into that field are often not going in it because they felt it was a good place for their investigative skills. They are people who love nature, want to be in nature as much as possible, and are, you know, not necessarily looking to make a lot of money. They're okay with that.
Yeah, I know a lot of park rangers who are very lovely people, but I get a lot of, you know, misidentified, you know, water snakes as cottonmouths and stuff like that. So yeah, not unheard of for them to not be super up on the actual rules and regulations going on there.
So what made you happy in this episode?
Made me happy. I really, really loved that Peggy just got her shoes and didn't have to feel any shame about it. That was just something that I truly loved to see for her, because she just has so much shame about so many things, which is a funny foil to her, you know, overly confident personality in general. Mm-hmm. But I like to see, you know, a low stakes Peggy B plot where just nice things happen for her.
It was a big win for Peggy.
Yeah. Right? That, you have to go so far.
Yeah. I mean, all the way to Lubbock, which at least required one hotel stay.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, not really sure. Like, regardless of whether you think Arlen is, and I mean, the creators have been pretty clear that they kind of move Arlen as they mm-hmm. need to. But if you're somebody who's going to really stick that it is outside of Dallas or yeah. outside of San Antonio or outside of Houston, it's a long way to Lubbock from anywhere.
Yeah.
I don't know mm-hmm. if you've ever been to Lubbock or been through Lubbock. There's not much close to Lubbock.
It's not much close to anything else in Texas.
I no, yeah. Once you get West Texas, yeah. There's, yeah. it's a, like, when you're driving through, like, you hit the Louisiana line, and, or when you cross over from Louisiana, and it's like, El Paso is like 812 miles, mm-hmm. and you're just like, mother.
Yeah, that's very
normal.
I'm
going to drive
yeah.
800 miles, and I'm still going to be in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've never driven, as someone who's driven cross country many times, I've never driven like all the way like the I-10, like the widest part of Texas.
I have.
In a day.
Yeah.
I've never done it in a day.
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. I stayed overnight in those.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no. I've done that several times, but I've never like in a single day went like, you know, entered in Louisiana, exited New Mexico, or vice versa.
I had like a road hallucination at 2 a.m. in like Ozona, like absolute like buttfuck nowhere, Texas. One time I was driving. I'd been driving for like 13 hours. I was mm-hmm. moving to the West Coast. And I started hallucinating that there were like little green men aliens in the middle of the road. I was just like, nope, 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 nope. And I had to turn around because we had been like 50 miles past the last hotel.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm going to kill us both. Like, if we don't just go back and stay at this hotel right now. So very much a hypnotic kind of bizarre place to be at night.
I had once, I was driving, this is when I was moving from New Orleans to Los Angeles and was also moving to the West Coast. Mm. And I had driven from New Orleans to San Antonio and like stayed the night. And then the next day I was like, okay, I can power through past El Paso, you know, so I can definitely make it to LA the next day.
Mm-hmm.
This happened to be, so this was in 2006 and I ended up not doing it, ended up pulling over and spending a night in a Motel 6 in Fort Stockton, just cause I decided I really wanted to watch that episode of The Sopranos. It was a Sunday and I didn't want to miss that and have to like try to get, I didn't know if the place yeah. I was moving to was going to have HBO and it's going to be whole things. So it's like, all right, so I'm going to like add a whole extra day to this trip
naturally,
so that
yeah.
I can watch this random episode of The Sopranos.
As one does.
Yes.
I respect it.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, you just go along and it's like, oil Derek, Dairy Queen, old Derek, Dairy Queen, and then New Mexico.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. From this episode, what are you grateful for?
I'm grateful for the perspective that this episode offered, not just on the characters, but on sort of the broader environmental message that we had touched on with mm-hmm. regards to just the sort of hypocrisy that exists in a lot of people who kind of style themselves as very eco-friendly, very liberal, and really don't live in accordance with their principles.
Yes.
So I was grateful that they managed to shine light on this in a way that was still really funny and very watchable and not kind of on the nose as I've seen it done in
right.
a lot of other sources of media. And that's what they're really good at, is taking these things that are real life problems and real life social dynamics and making them funny, but without losing what's important about them.
Yeah. And they didn't hugely lampoon it. They didn't make them like overtly evil. It wasn't like, oh, they were secretly, you know, drilling for oil
it's
out
like
of the school bus or something.
Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. They were, you know, it was just like, oh, look at this. They're, you know, words and actions not matching up.
Yeah, easy to feel superior to someone else and not be very self-reflective.
Yeah. I was grateful for this episode, and this is one of these I'm going to have to get away from trying to say this so much, but just the resolution of Hank and Bobby.
Mm-hmm.
And this was early on. I thought this was like a pivot, a key early one where just seeing that Bobby did not view his parents as antagonists, that he's like, no, I want to be your friend and I want to work with you. And like, I don't want to lie to you. I want us to be on the same team, me and you against the world, Dad. I was just very grateful for that. And because it's so easy to tell the story the other way. It's so easy to have the rebellious teen. And I mean, Hank obviously doesn't get Bobby. But it's not, there's at no point are either of them not trying to get along.
Mm-hmm.
They're both kind of trying to pull the other one a little bit closer to them. And they find like two things over 13 seasons they have in common. And that's great. But yeah, so I was just, as I often will be, very grateful for Hank and Bobby and them realizing at the end of these 22 broadcast minutes that they love each other and they are on the same team.
I think this is what makes King of the Hill such a special series and such a standout among similar offerings, too, is just that the humor very rarely feels like it has to be mean to be funny.
Yeah.
And especially when it concerns the main characters in the Hill family. There are a lot of family comedies that really take joy overtly in just kind of shitting on one character, having, you know, like a butt of the joke who's consistently demeaned in these episodes and kind of plot situations. And that just really never happens in King of the Hill, which I love.
No, they, yeah, despite all the times when you're like, oh, Hank's an uptight fuddy-duddy. But, you know, he's coming at things from a good place, and then he comes around, and you're like, oh, like, Bobby's being a little odd. But he's doing something that he's sincerely interested in. And, yeah, and then sometimes it's Bobby that has to come around, that he's like, you know, Dad was right. And, I mean, Peggy's always right, based on Peggy.
We don't
have to bring her around to anything. Peggy's just going to always be right.
Mm-hmm. Her and Bobby have such a good relationship in the show, too. But that's for another day, I suppose.
Yes.
Definitely a very Hank and Bobby episode.
There's definitely some Peggy-Bobby episodes. What do you rate this episode? So one Alamo to a full six-pack. What are you giving it?
I think it's got to be a four Alamo episode to me, because it's got so many elements of the series touched on in this episode that I truly love. The Hank and Bobby relationship, just bad things happening to the main crew because they've done something, you know, dumb that they need to pay for in, you know, karmic terms. But it was sort of a clumsy episode because it's episode three. You know, they're still trying to find their feet with a lot of these characters, a lot of the writing styles that they're going to get into. So while it doesn't quite hit the, you know, full six-pack peak of humor for me that some of the later episodes do, it has almost all of the elements that I find myself loving the most about the series, so I think it's definitely at least a four.
Follow Gina's Wiki on Twitter at Gina Goes Outside. Gina Goes Outside is also where you will find her on Patreon for more incredible wildlife photos and videos. Things are going great here at Clean Burn, but they could always be going better. Help more people find us with those 5-star ratings and reviews. Follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Clean Burn Pod, and join us at patreon.com/cleanburn for early access, ad-free episodes, bonus content, and more. Thanks for listening to Clean Burn.
I love King of the Hill. Thanks for having me. I'm going to go home and watch some more after this.
This has been a production of Defense Mechanism Records.